All right. Well, well, well. If it isn't Doggy Dog, a.k.a. Hanfeizi, how are you doing, man?
I'm good. Good. In Beijing.
Yeah. Sunday. Are you permanent resident there? Like, that's your home now.
Yeah, that's my home now.
And where were you before that? Were you living in?
I was in Hong Kong. I was 15 years in Hong Kong, and this is my second year.
Oh,
in Beijing,
wow. Okay.
Going on third.
Okay. And what's your connection to the U.S.? I mean, you sound like an American, and I know you worked.
Yeah, I grew up in the U.S., but I was born in mainland. I was born in Jiangxi.
Oh, okay.
But I grew up in the U.S. from the time I was six to, well, I went to high school and college in the U.S. And then I started going overseas, and I was back and forth between U.S. and various places overseas. But I've been in Asia pretty much off and on since late 1990s.
Ah, I see. Okay.
With a stint in New York City in between. It was traveling around a bit.
Yeah. And you're like a, I mean, I can tell by the, by the way, your handle is, let's see if I get this right here. Doggy with a Y, right? Doggy Dog 1208.
Twitter. Yes, there is implausible deniability that Doggy Dog has anything to do with Hanfeizi, but let's keep it at that.
Hanfeizi being the pen name of someone who writes. Is it for Asia Times or is it still there?
It's for Asia Times. It's for Asia Times, and Hanfeizi is a gentleman, and Doggy is not.
Yeah, when we talk with Doggy, we could talk about top 10 ladies of China watching.
Top 10 ladies of China watching. Oh.
I actually really enjoy your long form articles as Han, and you have a light touch with it. You have fun with it. I feel like a lot of this stuff about U.S. China, especially when it comes to national security, war, economics, trade, is becoming very almost mock, like it's almost absurdly serious at this point. And
there's no real media outlet that will let anybody publish anything of any value. It's just all garbage out there. Besides these niche outlets like Asia Times. So you really have to go to like individual substacks of people or these really niche out of the way things like Asia Times that can actually tell you anything real.
Yeah.
If you go to like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, it's just I can't even get through it without retching.
How long have you been in this space in terms of, observing, I mean, were you primarily looking at, cross-border investments, trade, economics, that kind of thing, or geopolitics?
My career is equity research, which is, buy, hold, sell of companies. And I've covered, in the beginning, I was trained in New York, so covering U.S. companies, but for 15 years or so, I was in Hong Kong doing China companies, all China companies. So, I've been an observer so I've been an observer for about 30 years of all this stuff. So I've seen lots of news cycles come and go, and I've seen the mainstream media never ever getting any better.
Oh, do you think it's always been this bad, or do you think it's sort of like hitting a nadir now?
It's always been bad. Now it's getting more and more absurd just because there's more and more of it. As in 20 years ago, it wasn't the top news all the time.
Right.
So now it's all over the place. It's all in your face. So there's more stuff that has a possibility of being laughable.
So it's all shit, but now the shit's been amplified and it's sort of like,
yes, there's a lot more shit. Yeah. Just a lot more shit.
What do you think is your primary sort of objection to the way, I would say, like
the way China's covered.
Yeah. First of all, are you focused more, like you're focused more on the trade side and finance side, or Is that what you're really interested in, right? Or is it also
I just
the
write about what
national security stuff?
I just write about what's interesting to me. And the things that are interesting to me that I have some expertise on is commenting on economics, right? And then I write some cultural articles as well. I haven't quite actually delved into, as Han fades, the national security side. I covered some a little bit of a fun piece of Han fades advising Donald Trump as Han fades.
That was good. That was really good. And in fact, I think a lot of your observations there, particularly about sort of like the stalking threat of Elon Musk has sort of come to a head in the last couple of days.
Exactly.
You know, with all this H-1B stuff going on.
Yeah. So, I keep thinking of what Doggy Dog comments a lot about national security stuff, especially when he trolls
Elbow Patch, who's now going to be like some sort of deputy undersecretary or something.
Coffee fetcher.
We should talk about him later. But LB's an interesting guy. Elbow Patches.
So Doggy Dog comments on national security stuff, but Han Feizi has kept out of it so far.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. So what does Han think of the sort of the overall arc? Okay, let's put it this way. You mean, I think that the U.S. narrative, if I'm just an ordinary American, which I am, I think of this as China, over the past several decades, China has pretended to be a sidekick ally. It entered the WTO under our auspices, but because of its unique communist structure, centrally planned, extremely centralized authority, it was able to subsidize industry in a way that the free market Americans could not, and therefore conspired at least with American corporations to relocate manufacturing and physical capital to China. And this was all part of a master plan. We thought China would just sort of develop into a sort of westernized country, a big Japan, someone that would work with us and be our friend. But instead, they stayed communist. Xi Jinping has returned the country to its authoritarian Maoist roots. And now they are waging total economic war upon us, their former friend. And we need to wisen up and start hitting back. That's the sort of general view that I'm sensing from Americans. Would you agree with that? And that is the general view. And what's wrong if it is? What is wrong with that view? What's incorrect about it?
I definitely agree. That's a general view. And the thing about the general view is, in Western media, when they write about China taking that view, there is a kernel of truth in all of that. So they all base it on a kernel of truth. But it's not the grand truth is not that. The grand truth is something rather boring. China really just worked very hard under the WTO system, went up the skills ladder, the value add ladder. And then now the U.S. is freaking out because China is now able to challenge the U.S. in all these advanced industries. And it's, flexing its muscles to get some more play in this region. What China is very much afraid of is the U.S. has a history of shutting down economies that challenge it. So China is just trying to insure itself against not having that be able to done to them.
When you say there's grains of truth, how much truth is there in the idea? Let's go through some of the accusations one by one that China stole intellectual property and other forms of knowledge from the West by forcing, various means, espionage, mandated joint venture disclosure and just outright, you know, theft.
Oh, definitely grains of truth there. Definitely grains of truth there. One is a lot of it was just given away by the deal. They made a deal. You want market access, we get tech transfers. Exactly what Europe is trying on Chinese car companies right now. That's definitely happening. There definitely was, intellectual spying where Chinese people took intellectual property and developed it within China. That happens, but that grain of truth, when you look at it, that's exactly how the U.S. developed as well, 100, 150 years ago. They robbed Europe blind. That's just how it happens. So, yeah, you can say China did that, but that's pretty much the only way. If you're not stealing, you're not doing anything.
That kind of makes me as an American feel, though, that, maybe some of the ire is warranted and that perhaps we should be playing hardball and yes, setting up sanctions. And
I am not one. I am not one to say that China is totally innocent in the IP. I wouldn't call it theft. I would just call it IP is hard for me to think of as actual property, as in. If I steal it from someone, it's not like that person has lost it. Yeah. He still has it. It's just knowledge. So for countries to say this idea belongs to me, they can only do that when they have power in the world. When you're a hegemon, you can say and enforce that ideas belong to me. And if you want to use them, you have to pay through the notes.
Right, right.
So,
well, I would say, I think that sounds right to me because when it comes to intellectual property, which is a fairly new term, I mean, that wasn't in wide use even 25, 30 years ago, as far as I remember. We would talk more about patents and copyright and stuff like that. We didn't bring it all under this rubric of IP until fairly recently. And I felt like the emergence of IP in the American lexicon, the American business lexicon, marked a period. It sort of began as we deindustrialized.
Yes, it's kind of when you cannot collect a margin on manufacturing anymore because you've lost that ability or skill or the equipment and it's all moved away. You grab at IP to collect what you can.
And it seems to be in the form of a rent, right? Because the patent itself offers, there's no, you could say that, their research and development went into the patents, but anyone that actually has practiced any form of patent law knows that that's not actually how it works. You have a separate patent department that's patenting the shit out of everything all the time. you're going and buying patents. You're amassing a patent, what they call a patent war chest, and it's a land grab, right?
Yes. My father worked at I won't mention the company, but a major U.S. company. In the patent, he was a PhD physicist, but he was in that patent office to put together all of the tens of thousands of patents in that company. To go after and scrape out rents from all the competitors. And they were doing the same thing. So it's this big, huge patent war between all the players.
Yeah, it's a sort of land grab, territorial battle between large companies. And to an extent, there's a feudal aspect to this, right? It's sort of like a intellectual feudalism where, we're using, like you said, we're using hard power via the system to, and we have patent treaties, and I think TPP was going to supposed to be a major intellect, like that was one of the major pillars of TPP, right? Was going to be uniform IP laws.
Yep.
And the emergence of IP as a concept, especially international, because IP, like patents are a national thing, right? Like you have a patent within the domain of the United, of this kingdom or this state to exclusively sell this thing. But then IP sort of internationalized that concept to say, no, my my rights to this particular type of technology, this class of technology, is global. And that, yeah, that seemed to me to be a way for the US to sort of have its cake and eat it too, to say, we want the benefit of other countries beyond our borders to actually practice this technology, i.e. to produce it. But at the same time, we want to maintain total control and ownership of it. And I feel like, I don't know, there's something inherently anti-capitalist about that? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, if it is practiced in good faith, there's definitely a role for patents. But I suspect that now, there's so many patent troll firms that don't do any research, just collect patents so that lawyers within the firm sue other companies to collect a fee, that the whole system has been corrupted. So, in the end, all patents are becoming more and more, because the U.S. has lost the ability to actually make things, it is using essentially lawfare to collect an economic rent out of places that actually do make things, and also to try to prevent those places from, because to move from technology A to technology C, you got to go through technology B, which has a patent on it. So if you're going up the value added ladder, there's all these patent trolls out there that will try to collect their little piece.
Yeah, right. And then that's one piece. You have the branding piece, the network effects, to say, like, we're going to kick you out of the Google services ecology, that kind of thing. We're throwing everything we can to. Like, fundamentally speaking, like, all this stuff about the smartphones and the chips and Huawei and all this stuff, and the U.S. is trying to, prosecute a sort of trade war to, like, protect our, to protect the smartphone market. But we, as far as I know, like, not a single major smartphone brand or line is actually made in the United States, right? Like, that was one of the weirdest things about the whole Huawei saga, was we did this. Meanwhile, our entire Apple and
Apple and Qualcomm, they're probably the two biggest. They collect huge margin from smartphones. They manufacture none of the smartphones. They manufacture none of the chips, but they do the design and the quote unquote IP part of it. So that's what the U.S. is trying to, has done, which it turning out that people are panicking. That's all the U.S. has left, this design part that can be only enforced by insisting that you have an intellectual right over it.
And this has been used in other realms, right? Like in other markets, like a Nike doesn't engage in any manufacturing. It uses contract manufacturing all over the world, including China. A lot of the big super profitable American brands do that. But their point is the actual production of the article is of minimal value. The big value is the design, the marketing, and the branding.
I mean, this is all the European. That's the LVMH business model. That's all the manufacturing is supposedly made in Italy and France, but if you really go there and look, it's all shipped in Chinese workers, or a lot of it's made in China. And the last bit of stitching to make it qualified as a made in Italy, it's done in Italy. So the whole ecosystem is done so that certain places collect a huge amount of the margin, while other places just manufacture en masse. Now the problem with this model is the places that can do this in France and Italy, in Mountain View, California, those employees are you know, the marketers, the Apple phone designers, they're making $100,000 a year. They're living large. But that's only tens of thousands of jobs.
Yeah.
So, you know, the average Italian that, you know, 30, 40 years ago was stitching LV handbags or whatever they made there. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, the average American was working on a Dell assembly line. Well, they got nothing to do now. You know, they're working menial and more and more menial service jobs, where the gig economy.
Which completely dovetails with the observed, you know, gap, the wealth gap in Western countries, right? Yep. But what's your theory on why Western firms did this in the first place? Now, I know, like, the standard answer is cheap labor and, you know, no environmental regulations or whatever it is. I've always found that to be, like, I don't know. It makes sense to me to a degree, but I also feel like it's incomplete.
I mean, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, there was a land rush. You know, I was part of this. And we advise firms in this land rush to everything shipping to China. The salivation was, one, you can get everything done for cheap, but just as importantly, you're staking a beachhead where, you know, China's market would be just as big, if not bigger, than U.S.
I see.
So if you're not there first, you know, just first to manufacture for yourself and to you know, increase your margins, then, and also to set up, you know, your China office, then you're out of the wall. You're going to get blown away, and it's worked for a lot of companies.
So you were part of this chorus. This would make it into your equity research reports, or you would suggest to the companies that you cover that they do this, that they
not my reports. That there was a certain time where I worked for an engineering company that was moving a lot of stuff to China. Building factories in China. So this was before I entered finance. Mm-hmm. I worked for an engineering company that was building factories in China. So we would go around US, Midwest conferences. And then there was these conferences that were just about looking for people like us to, you know, turnkey projects to build factories in Shanghai or Guangdong or wherever, and we provide all different tiers of services for them. And then they're at that time, the big thing that was being thrown around is the China price. You know, there's a price that they can produce whatever gizmo. What's the China price? The China price is always a fraction of that. So in their eyes, bling bling is they can even in their head, you can see them calculating next quarter's margins.
I see. So it was a major factor, was the cost of production.
Yep. Cost of production. And the other thing we sell to them is that, you know, this is what you do for the first couple of years. Next couple of years after that, then your sales domestically will be X percent of your total.
I see.
And grow.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds, I mean, they draw, people like to draw comparisons, I think facile comparisons to Japan in the late 80s and 90s. But this is a little bit different, right? Because
Japan never had this. Japan never had, let's invite everybody in to set up shop. And one, Japan's market wasn't all that big.
Right.
So
right.
Not too many people would be
able to do that. People weren't salivating for the Japanese market. Yeah.
Correct. And I don't think Japan had, for that period of time, very low labor costs.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Japan never started on, it was already industrial. It was a fought World War II, right? So it succeeded largely just by excellence in engineering.
Right. And superior organization and efficiency.
Correct.
And
so it's a different animal, similar but different animal. China pretty much used 20 years to to advance like 50 years with this outsourcing in the beginning where they were just doing menial low-level work. And in a decade or two later, it all ramped up. So
yeah, you know,
that's what people
this story a lot. Like the first time I went to China, mainland China, was 2003, 2004. And, you know, if I remember, like, that was a very different time. And I still think that back then there was like this vision of this. I mean, people by 03, 04, you could tell like things were happening in China big time, right? Huge amounts of construction, huge amounts of just energy. Things were happening. And I feel like there was a general vision among American business executives who went there. And I remember some American bankers noticed me and my friend speaking English, and they were suddenly excited to talk to us and stuff. And I could tell by the way they were talking that first time they'd been in China that the American eye just saw, I think these guys were from Citi, just saw Citibank, you know, Citibank branches everywhere all over Shanghai one day. They saw, you know, every company in America saw the sort of reproduction of their footprint in America extended at a magnitude greater and into this sort of like new world that they didn't really know very well. There was a sort of like expansionist fervor in the air. I don't know if I'm accurately describing the feeling back then, but
there was definitely that. There was definitely that. And it even succeeded for some people. Not pretty much it didn't succeed in general, but it succeeded for many. Like Yum Brands, that is Pizza Hut, KFC, McDonald's, is on every corner in China. Starbucks is on every corner in China. It's running into problems now. We can get into that.
But Volkswagen seemed to be doing real well back then. I remember they were everywhere.
Correct. General Motors sold more cars in China than the United States. It was on its knees after the financial crisis, and then China is what pulled it out. So the U.S. or European companies, a lot of them have succeeded far and above. And, you know, Apple has Apple stores all over the place. So there have been huge success stories of Western companies that have gotten China right. Now, not every, because I bet every U.S. company thought that they could win in China. But, of course, not every, but many have.
Do you think it's the case that this expansionary fervor that of that era just blinded American planners to the effects that this would have in the American industrial centers and, you know, the Rust Belt? Did they really believe that they would be converted, you know, sort of like all these people would just move up the value chain and become sort of like highly paid service workers or something? And
I don't think in the U.S. these companies, the executives in these companies cared. They are incentivized by very narrow things. They are incentivized in next quarter's earnings, you know, year-end results. So what happens to their workers is not their business. What happens to their workers is the business of the politicians. And
if Trump was in power then, and here's the thing I will say about Trump, that he has been remarkably consistent about his feeling that there is some imbalance in this in foreign trade, particularly with Japan and now with China. He may not be wrong about. If we had a Trump style leader back then, don't you think the tariffs idea to say, look, if you're an American company and you want to relocate your manufacturing to Asia and you want to then sell what was formerly built here back here, we're going to put a tariff on that. Like, I feel like that might be at that time. It might be too late at this point, but at that time, that might have been sensible policy. No?
I told this story before, and I don't know if people would just have the capitalist class sort of just wiggled out of it, because back then when all this was going down, this professor who ended up starting a quite successful consulting company, a professor in grad school. His solution to all this was pay them off. So that was what was being sold to these factory workers that were getting shut down in Cleveland, was the gains of globalization would be so great that we could just take part of it and pay off these factory workers and everybody would be better off.
Because the aggregate, now, there would be enough in the aggregate to account for their losses. Yes.
Correct, because supposedly this pie would grow. So, and I suspect that's true. I suspect if you actually did the numbers, the new wealth that was generated, the new GDP wealth generated, if you took a portion of that and you paid off the factory worker that lost his job and even paid him off a little more, there would be enough for everyone to be better off.
I think you said in that article that the scale of the wealth that was built through that was massive and sort of beyond ordinary comprehension.
Yeah.
Can you wrap our minds around that? Like, how?
Just look at the S&P mm-hmm. chart. Bring that chart up. Look what has happened to it from the year 2000 till now.
Yeah.
That's it. You're looking at it. You're looking at globalization right there. Who owns that? That's the problem. 51% of that. Wait, no. 1% of that is owned by 54% of the population.
Yeah.
I got this backwards. 1% of the population owns 54% of the S&P, of the U.S. stock market. So that's the problem. Nobody got paid off. All the gains came in, and it all got hoarded. Who did it get hoarded by? Well, people like me going to grad school in muckety-muck institutions and getting let loose out into investment banking. So back then, if Trump existed back then, would his eyes have been all gone googly and said, oh, yeah, pay them off. Yeah.
Explain to me the connection between the... you know, this deindustrialization process, the offshoring of physical production, the expansion of global markets with stock price. I know that seems obvious. I think you probably appreciate maybe it's not so straightforward as that. Like, why, or is it as straightforward as that? But like, what causes the stock market to explode in value the way it has, to the point where we're now 3-4 decades into this like mega run up of stocks?
It's basically just two things. One is profits get bigger and bigger, so profit just keep growing and grows consistently, and that's that
compounding profits.
Stock prices. Yes, and we had a financial crisis a few years ago, a decade and a half ago. But if as long as that don't happen too often, you know, that was just a speed bump. So basically, your stock price is based on your profits, and then you put a multiple on it. If you keep growing, you grow consistently, that multiple gets bigger and bigger. So right now, the stock market is at nosebleed expensive because they think it's getting pretty scary. But the idea is that the U.S. market will keep sucking in the benefits of the economy, will keep accruing to share prices.
Right. Right.
So what happens, especially this past 5 years or so, the stocks that have really driven it are just seven companies.
Right. The Mag 7.
Yeah. And these, the Mag 7. And then, if you really sit down and think about it, maybe all seven, but definitely six, they will swear up and down, left and right, that they are not monopolies. But come on, man. Six of them are monopolies.
Well, okay, but let's take, for example, like a Google or something. They've been effectively locked out of the Chinese market. I think Meta has been locked out of the Chinese market.
Yep.
Amazon doesn't play in the Chinese market.
It does. Amazon is
definitely sourcing, but in terms of selling,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, they all source from China, I'm sure, at some level.
Yes.
Who else is in that Mag 7? Well, Apple sells into China.
Apple, NVIDIA.
NVIDIA is being sort of like in limbo in terms of its ability to sell into China now. Like it's...
Yeah, yeah.
So...
It's not so necessarily that they're exactly China levered. It's that these are the companies that are scraping the profits that are generated by the entire U.S. economy. Mm. The entire U.S. economy has a wallet of so much, and the wallet of so much, all these other companies are not able to get any of it because it all ends up in advertising on Google and Meta. It all ends up in NVIDIA, which all these companies are buying because you need to run their AI to get addicted users. That's what has happened to the U.S. economy, where these platform monopolies are scraping up the wallet share of every other company and all the people in the U.S.
That
as well.
Sounds a bit like the Varoufakis concept of cloud capital, to say that what these are, as you put it, they're really platforms. They're really pieces of digital territory upon which, trade has to take place on Amazon stand. And in order to have the right to sell on Amazon, you've got to allocate the bulk of your profits to me as in the form of what is essentially a rent. So it through this sort of like, if we can think of it broadly as, I'm just saying this to test this idea with you and see what you think. Mm-hmm. But if the last several decades in the advent of the internet and e-commerce meant the creation of cyberspace, a digital realm in which transactions take place, that was developed such that the ownership rights of that new space fell to private hands, and those private hands may be roughly described as what we call the Mag 7. Maybe not all of them, but the Mag 7 now is a sort of like, I don't know what the term is, but like maybe like a system of duchies or something, like some kind of realm, like some sort of like divided realm where each of these has a kind of, sort of like a royal, like a noble title to. And in order simply to exist within their part of cyber space, just to transact, you got to pay a tax. I think that's kind of the idea.
That's in any healthy economy where your regulators are not captured, they would go there and they would smack these guys around. So that's what happened in China. They saw Alibaba get too big for its britches. They saw Alibaba and Tencent, and they went there and just smacked them silly. So that's why those are not trillion-dollar companies. They were well on their way to be trillion-dollar market cap companies. But you have things like WeChat in China. There's not a single ad on WeChat in China.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most used app. But Tencent clearly understands that if they try to maximize monetization on WeChat, they'll be hell to pay.
Do you think the Chinese authorities understood it in those terms, that you kind of wanted to think of this as sort of like land distribution, and you wanted to do land reform before you needed it, that kind of thing? Or?
Yes, they definitely understood this, because they even said in a lot of their documents that data is one of the factors of production, and it can't belong to anybody but the people.
Really? Wow. When was that? Yeah, like, so how early were they starting to sense this?
This was I want to say 2020-ish.
Okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been around for a while. So when they smacked down Alibaba, the griping in the West was that they felt threatened by a private company. You know, if you keep letting this go, then a private company would threaten the rule of the CPC, which we're like, well, yeah. These internet companies in the U.S. run roughshod over all their regulators. And then you also see it has done quite a lot of good, because really, in the past decade or so, China's e-commerce and internet economy is far more user-friendly, innovative, and just better than the U.S. platform companies. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have the innovation. I mean, all these monopolies in the U.S. has nipped all innovation in the bud. That's why you have things like TikTok that's challenging Meta and Google, and not something that came out of the U.S. because nothing will come out of the U.S. You have Shein and Temu that's challenging Amazon. Well, because nothing in the U.S. could challenge Amazon. So it's all stuff that's coming out of China because they want to make sure that it's not monopolies. It's still innovative.
Yeah, I know that there's been a recent resurgence of interest in sort of competition law under Lina Khan but it just, I don't know, it just seems like in the U.S. I mean, we went through this with Microsoft and in the sort of early 2000s, and they claimed to have broken the Microsoft monopoly, but I don't see that having happened. I doubt that Lina Khan and her band at the FTC is going to be able to break the.
No, well, she's gone. She's gone in a couple of weeks.
Oh, right? Really? They're not. So, yeah, she's out.
I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea if she's. But I suspect if anybody can break it, it would be something like Elon Musk and Doge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that going to be his priority? I don't know. But these platform monopolies in the U.S. Are just way too
powerful. Do you think that that's a major obstacle to American innovation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because not only that, but the platform monopolies have kind of destroyed U.S. tech talent. As in, all the top graduates, so not even top, every decent computer science major all want to work for the Mag 7 and get their $300,000 starting compensation package or whatever ridiculous amount it is. And not only that, but all of engineering in the U.S. has been eaten by computer science. As in, I went to college in the 90s, and computer science was just one of, six or seven
engineering
majors. Now, half the people in engineering, more than half, are computer science majors, and the people who are mechanical engineering majors are learning to code on the side.
So you're saying that the monopoly, the de facto monopoly power of these companies are sort of sucking up all the profits into one place, and therefore attracting all talent into one sector,
the only ones.
And at vastly inflated salaries, away from no really smart MIT gal is going to want to go into railroad engineering.
Right? Yeah, correct. You know, or Boeing.
Or Boeing, yeah.
We'll pay you a starting salary of, say, $100,000 a year. Google will pay you a starting salary of MIT grad of $300,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, one company gets more and more powerful and planes are falling out of the sky.
So
when you have these monopolies that suck up all these profits, and then paying $300,000 salaries for staffs in the tens of thousands is nothing when your profits are, in the hundreds of billions, right?
There was a guy who's had some banger tweets recently about this H-1B nonsense that's going on over here. And he had, the meme where the Houston Astros fan with the wraparound sunglasses getting a little too close to that girl, the hot blonde girl.
Oh, yeah.
He's explaining to her something that she has no interest in. So he was like, okay, so you see, they released 2 6th-gen fighters that day. One of them is a dogfighter. The other one is a long-range bomber. Therefore, we need to import 1 million Indians into this country with fake paperwork and put them in a 6-week Java boot camp. And I thought, I thought, you know, that's so, it's actually quite funny because nobody wants to go work on stealth fighters. No, like no one's you know, really smart STEM oriented person's dream is to go work on the F-35's avionics. And why not? I mean, when I was a kid, like that, you know, and we watched Top Gun, like a lot of people, every kid would be like, hell yeah, I want to go work on that stuff. Nobody wants to work on stealth fighter technology now, you know.
You get socialized really quickly. And then it's really bad. But I'll tell you my story is all I wanted to do was to work on cars when I went to college in the '90s. So I interviewed all the car companies for an internship, and I got all the offers from General Motors, Ford, all of them. And then so I was really happy. But when I went there, I found, these are state school kids. Mm. And then you go through the rest of your college and you find out that all your other engineering, this is '90s, so before tech was a big thing, all your other engineering friends are all applying to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley.
Yeah. Like, or management consulting was a big buzzword back then.
Yeah. So consulting, and then they say, oh, you can get a technical job somewhere in the Midwest. That's freaking flyover country. And then so you get
herd mentality, right?
Socialized. And then and you are being stupid if you go there. Because, you know, the starting salary back then we're, you know, giving back then numbers of, you know, Wall Street was something like $85,000. And then if you go to the Midwest to, you know, work for Ford, it's like $45,000.
Right, right. And you're living in the Midwest. There's no respect for that. But so China, how does it avoid this problem? Because I don't know. It seems to me that there is a number of places that people would like to land, and I feel like not everyone wants to live in Shanghai, not everyone wants to live in Beijing. They're happy to move to other, I don't know, is that true?
What I do know is that China has gone through, especially this year and last, it's going on about 3 years now, where they have been forcing the banks to lower total compensation packages in the financial field. So now finance was a really hot field to go in for about a decade. Now it's dead. It's like nobody in the top students don't want to major in finance. Because somewhere, and then it's totally not a market-driven solution. Totally not. It's definitely the government coming down and saying, look, we got to... Because there have been cases of finance people misbehaving and you know, being too full of themselves and driving their BMWs around, you know. So, you know, they want more and more people to, for the STEM grads, the people with that talent, to go into something, you know, quote unquote, real. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, and also the distribution of, like, it seems like there's a decent spread of companies and activity into different cities, and this city will be, well, maybe it's how it works in the US too, but like this city will be, Chengdu will be where all the aerospace is, and
this is something that had just cropped up in the past five or six, seven years, you know, maybe even less than that. But it used to be in China, there's only like four decent cities. Mm-hmm. You know, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, Guangzhou. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in Hangzhou, which was really cool, coming up real fast because of Alibaba's there. Now, it seems to be there are dozens that are as cool and funky and cool in their own quirky way. Yeah. So now there's got to be like a dozen cities that I would consider living in. Because they're just as cool in a first tier sense as, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, about a dozen. And then even the second tier cities, it's, you know, this cool shit there. And then there are artist communes all over the place. So if you're a hippie kid, so something in the last 5 years or so where China kind of tripped over some sort of a threshold of lifestyle and cool that out of the way podunk places can compete with first tier cities.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an important thing to happen, because I do think I find that there's this the herd mentality starts obviously with this you know, this huge blowout in salaries in one particular sector, and it's always some you know, it's always some fucking bullshit, right? It's always some fucking bullshit.
Yeah, it's always some fucking
But then that works its way into the culture, right? And so it's sort of like the Marxist interplay between the base and the superstructure, right? Like, I can kind of see that. It kind of does work its way into the sort of like mindset and culture where we now have in America this really sort of sick sort of FOMO culture and this hive mind culture where everyone seems to be chasing the same thing. And
there's so much bullshit thrown around. Yeah. Just like crypto has been around for 15 years.
Right? Yeah.
I've been hearing about crypto 15 years. There's still no real use case that I can really figure out besides money laundering, right? And AI, which was supposed to change everything, 2 years now. And it is doing party tricks. And it seems like it only the big use case is cheating on homework. You know, coders use it a lot, but it hasn't gone down into everyday stuff yet. Maybe I'm just a Luddite and not using it the way it's supposed to be used, but everybody is chasing the next thing. And there's a huge layer of bullshit that you got to wade through and you can't figure out.
Yeah. I always wondered, like, why is it the bullshit that attracts? And then I realized, like, as we're talking, like, maybe it has a lot to do with the fact that wherever the monopoly, you know, the monopoly is, you know, like how much real innovation is that monopoly going to be doing? And how much of it is just sort of bullshit and, you know, a lot of make work in the sense
Once you're a monopoly. Yeah. Once you're a monopoly, you don't want to innovate.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you innovate, you might just like Kodak actually invented the digital camera. And then they went out of business, right? So
they put themselves out of business in a way, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to innovate. You want to keep it going for as long as possible.
Yeah, because I started hearing about all this stuff where there were some theories, and I think that well-founded theories, that like the FANG companies were bidding up salaries simply to take talent off of the market so startups... Yeah. They were building a moat, and they were just keeping them off the market so that they wouldn't go to startups that might create a competing product or service, you know, so.
Yep. That's absolutely what has happened in a lot of people who work for FANG companies, you know, for Google and stuff. They'll tell you they've been there for, you know, 5-10 years, and it's all working on crap projects or nothing at all. And they tell them to sit there and be creative. And then they've been totally enjoy themselves. The cafeterias, the work-life balance.
Also the TikTok day in the life of videos.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And then basically there's a core of people that maintain everything to keep the monopoly going as long as possible. But if you really wanted these Google people to be innovative, you know, they might put themselves out of business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So develop the technology in-house and then bury it forever if it's a threat.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think there is something to this. I think that there definitely is, like, a lot of the stuff out there, the phenomenon of these young people with no hard technical skills, you know, 29-year-old product manager of some shit we never heard of at Meta getting paid, you know, multiples, hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, eat snacks, it makes people a little bit crazy to see, because they're like, what's the secret here? Like, how do these people generate value? What, like, you know, what is, I think a lot of people are mystified by this, like, because they still seem to be dogmatically following the assumption that you know, people get paid as some fraction of what their overall productive value to the company is. And under conditions of like competition, that might be true, but under conditions of this sort of like techno-feudalism, which I think is what we're describing.
Yeah, I think under conditions of a monopoly, yeah. your compensation, I've never added up, but your compensation for your employees is a tiny, tiny, tiny number. You can double it, you can triple it, you can have it. It doesn't, it's a rounding error for the mm-hmm. bottom line.
Yeah.
So because of that, then, you know, a strategy could very well be to hire all the PhDs you can get your hands on and just stick them in a room so that your competitors don't get their hands on them.
Yeah, that really seems to be the way we're going. But
So the only thing to break that up is either you need government regulation to come in and say, you know, you're a utility now. You're not doing anything but providing utility. We're going to cap your margins. And then so therefore, you can't pay everybody that much anymore. You're going to do all kinds of stuff. Or foreign competitor like TikTok will come in because there was actually innovation somewhere else. Now, when TikTok comes in, then you have Metas running around Congress trying to shut it down.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, does that suggest that there will be increasing levels of protectionism because American monopolists want to protect, you know, their home market?
Oh,
and, you know,
I think absolutely. I think the U.S., there really isn't a lot of competitive markets in the U.S., nothing like China. I mean, there's a handful of auto companies, and I can just imagine their collusion. There's 100 players in China, and the way they compete is bloodthirsty. It's savage. You know, they cut prices to the bone. They want to drive everybody out of business. You know, if you had any competitor in the U.S. like that, if Ford suddenly, you know, gets a shot of steroids and its goal was to drive GM out of business, then we might have something that's cool. But no, they're just going along.
Yeah, it's I don't know if we're going to be able to fix it. But I don't know if there is. I mean, this I gather this state of affairs can't last for that long.
What happens is you can't just open it up to free competition and then everybody will have a fire lit under their ass. And then you have to change because that's what makes you change is competition. But if you put tariffs on and if the tariffs don't have a strategic way of putting them on, like you put it on and then it's well understood by everyone that it goes off in 5 years, then what you have is the U.S. falls further and further and further and further behind. And then all the scientists in the U.S. will say, oh, all the innovative work isn't being done here anymore. It's being done overseas. I'm leaving. Mm. And then it becomes a developing country, right? Then it just gets left behind.
Yeah. So I wonder then if this is where your boy Elbows, Elbow Patch comes in, where there might be a sort of like another dimension to this competition that goes beyond business competition. And now we're talking about harder forms of enforcement, including military and things, coercive matters that sort of lead up to that.
Because if you let this run, if you let this system run just on the physics of business, and nothing really changes in the U.S. as in it doesn't try to be more competitive and do things with better and more competition at home, then the U.S. will be left behind. It's just done. The game is over. Or you can throw a wrench into all this, which is, you know, the U.S. has a whole bunch of military assets right offshore of China. So you can always concoct something where you can set back China by, you know, a few decades with just a modest little war. Now, I can't believe that there are people who are in power who believe this and are trying for it, but I can totally believe the just the all the systems in play will push toward that outcome.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. By its own sort of internal logic, everyone's going to have their particular narrow incentive to go in that direction. And the net result is we all are heading in that direction, even without a master plan, per se, do that.
Correct. That's exactly it. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. And therefore, China's response and to this kind of this blob that's rolling in this direction is it's got to build up its military and make sure that if you do choose it, then, well, everybody's going to be in for a lot of pain.
Right, right. Which, by the way, we're at an hour. I thought that might be a nice jumping off point if you're so inclined to talk about maybe the NatSec side of this for a little bit.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So, yeah we'll continue this on the bonus portion. So if you want to hit that, if you want to hear that part of it, you can go to the Patreon feed, and if you want to be a supporter, go to patreon.com/planamag. All right.